Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Really, WSM.
Welcome to the Really 007 podcast. I'm your host, Tom Pickup, and in tonight's episode, we'll be discussing...
The Man with the Golden Gun!
Oh.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to, you know, the start of a, what, 15-hour podcast, and I've ruined my voice already. Disastrous. Anyway, we are building up quite the back catalogue of reviews, tributes, and specials. And that just sounds like everybody's dying, doesn't it? But anyway, all of them can be found on iTunes and Spotify. Simply search for us at Really007Pod. We're available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you again search Really007, and do feel free to join in on the daily debates. Special shout out on this episode to Mr. Gert Jan of Wateringh. I hope I've pronounced that correct. And let's hope we fill you with more joy on this episode than we did with our Skyfall review. So. Sorry, Gert. Also, another shout-out to Feedspot, who recently, well, not that recently now, named us in the top 35 James Bond podcasts in the world. I mean, I don't know how many there are, but it's still pretty good considering we only began in August 2020. So thank you guys at Feedspot for that. Right, tonight we have a bumper squad, a six-man squad, discussing the divisive Roger Moore Kung Fu movie. We have Mr. John Kell. We don't have to say hello. We'll go. We have Chris Goldie.
Bonjour, Mr. Bond.
That sort of thing. Yeah. We have Harry Pickup.
Hiya.
We also have Matthew Pickup. We are related. And special guest star tonight, Mr. Stephen Carty.
I sure am, boy.
Very good. So, if you guys haven't heard the Henchman episode yet, Stephen Carty is now hopefully a regular guest on the Really 007 pod. He sort of went into his background on that episode, but I think if you haven't heard that, let's just have a little brief introduction to Mr. Carty. So, how did you sort of get into the world of James Bond, Stephen?
We went away for a family holiday for the weekend, and I was ill, and when I came back. Dr. No was on the TV, and my dad said, "Well, you'll love this." And it was just luck that it was the first film. I remember being hypnotized sort of 5 minutes into it, and then after that, just watched all of them. And I mean, I love about 10 of them, maybe 12 of them. I like nearly all of them. I think there's something good in every single one of them. There's not. I mean, when I do my selective rewatch, I'm sure you guys are the same. There are a couple that I skip, but. Over the years, I find my opinions change. Like, for example, when I was young, I loved You Only Live Twice. Now I'm a bit cooler on that. I've never really got into From Russia With Love. I know that is complete sacrilege, but it's not the sort
in this parish.
I can see why everyone likes it, but I'm going to keep watching it until I like it. One of the things I found most surprising about Bond Twitter was the kind of hate for the man with the golden gun. When I spoke to people in real life, I'd never met anyone that hated it. And when we were talking before we recorded about the ranking lists that Better Make That 2 is doing, and I was surprised to see how many people have it at the bottom or second bottom or near the bottom. I don't know how all you guys feel about it, but it's always been one of my favourites. I can see why people don't like it, but I was very surprised to find out how many people disliked it, like really hated it.
I think when you're growing up as a kid watching them, mm-hmm. you don't know how well they're critically received, do you? You've not a clue. So you just, yeah. your favourites are the ones that are your favourites. And I know our older brother James, this is his favourite James Bond film, and it still is. He did the poll as well, and he Man with the Golden Gun came top. So for a lot of fans, and he's not as diehard and sort of sad as we are, he loves it. He especially loves Roger Moore, of course. Mm. And even though we will discuss that perhaps it's not the most Roger Moore performance in a Roger Moore Bond film, it's still got all those classic elements, and I can see why people like it. But yeah, I think you're right, Stephen. We will discuss the various reasons, and perhaps one of the members here tonight will be the prosecution attorney, Mr. John Kell.
Oh, so John, you're not a fan?
Well, hang on.
Oh, sorry.
We spoil on it. I'm joking. I'll allow John an opening statement, perhaps. Oh, dear. Yes, in terms of your job, you're a film critic, aren't you?
Yeah, freelance film critic for about, I think 2006 was my first review. I actually read it last night, and excuse my French, it was fucking disastrous. It was so full of pompous, pretentious big words. I read it and I just thought, oh, I was clearly so desperate to let people know how much I knew about film, and I didn't have a clue. But yeah, so
it was 2006, you say, so does that mean it was Casino Royale?
That was my third review, actually.
Sorry.
I'd completely forgotten that I'd reviewed
that. Is it Marley and Me?
it was a Daniel Craig film called Renaissance. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It was
what?
It was a sort of black and white animated film that no one ever heard of.
Still waiting for Renaissance then, isn't it, I think?
So I write for Radio Times, and I go on the radio for BBC Radio Scotland, which has obviously been quite quiet recently. I'm sure you guys can understand.
Yeah.
There's nothing to review at the moment, so let's just watch Bond over and over and over.
Absolutely. So we do have an expert amongst our ranks, for once. Again, no offence intended to anybody else.
Well,
we're all professional amateurs now, I think.
When's the expert joining us?
Okay, guys, yeah, so tonight we're talking about The Man with the Golden Gun. This was, if you don't know, it's Roger Moore's second outing as James Bond. That's me talking to the audience, I'm sure the guys here know that. And it's often derided as one of the weakest entries in the series. Again, not a clue why. Perhaps we'll learn more tonight. However, as we've alluded to, I have it on good authority that a decent chunk of this panel are big fans of it. So fear not going into this episode, listeners. It won't be simply ripping it apart like that Skyfall film. And we've been in a bit of trouble for that review, but we stand by it. So yeah, on that episode, of course, it was John defending Skyfall versus everybody else. It could well be John silencing the Golden Gun versus everyone else tonight. Just going through each actor's second appearances as 007, because I think we do that an awful lot and try and compare. We had the highly successful From Russia With Love for Sean, the outstanding License to Kill for Tim, the fun Tomorrow Never Dies for Pierce, and the, you know, whatever word you want to describe Quantum of Solace.
Frustrating.
I'm not going to get into that. Frustrating, yeah. Stephen. Thank you. I didn't say that. So it's the ninth Bond film, and it came out in 1974, only a year later after Roger Moore's debut in Live and Let Die. This would be producer Harry Saltzman's final as the co-producer with Cubby Broccoli until he sold his share. Now, Live and Let Die, Roger's debut, had been a big success after On Her Majesty's Secret Service, of course, was pretty, well, lukewarm, and it was unfairly overlooked at the time. So the producers immediately set about work on the next one after the success of Live and Let Die. Shooting started just 5 months after the premiere. So, I mean, just think about that in these times of... We keep going about in this podcast, waiting over half a decade for this blessed film to come out. But anyway, there you go. More years have gone by than months had gone by after the last...
So they started shooting film, 5 months after, did you say? Shooting?
Yeah, Yeah. So they must have got an old story already.
Yeah, ready to go. Yeah.
So in this film, Bond must find out who is handing out golden bullets and why one is marked for him. He's sent after the Solex Agitator, a breakthrough solution to energy shortages. His mission takes him to Beirut, Hong Kong, Macau, and Thailand. And along his way, he meets the mysterious Knick-Knack, the less than mysterious Mary Goodnight, and the titular, the man with the golden gun. You got it?
Very good.
It's very titillating.
Yeah, very good.
What do you know about a man called Scaramanga?
The man with the golden gun. He always uses a golden bullet.
This trinket set with a note requesting special delivery to you.
I have never seen Mr. Scaramanga. Mr. Bond, this is impossible. I can't...
Don't kill me!
Who?
Scaramanga.
Roger Moore, back in action in the exotic East as James Bond, 007, on a collision course with the most dangerous man alive. The man with the golden gun.
Hold on, sir.
James Bond, on the job. The girls are willing.
I've dreamed about you setting me free.
The pace is killing.
Stay in there, good night. We've got you spotted.
How about demonstration, boy?
Certainly, sir.
You'll meet old friends and new enemies. It's non-stop Bond. The action is spectacular.
You're not.
I sure am, boy.
Reaching a new high for 007.
Bonjour, Monsieur Bond. I am Knick-Knack. Monsieur Scaramanga will welcome you personally.
The target is the highest-priced killer in the world. He plays a deadly game, and the stakes are sky high.
So, we've gone in the intro, we've found out a little bit what we think of the film. But let's just ask around the table what our particular relationship with the man with the golden gun is. Not him, he's a fictional character, but the film. So first of all, I'll turn my attention to Harry.
I don't know if I can wrap it all up in, you know, a short paragraph, but it's one that's always been fondly remembered, you know, from childhood. In my appearance on the From Russia With Love episode, I did say that Sean Connery was probably my favourite Bond. Certainly, he is at the moment. But growing up, Roger Moore, he was in the Bond films that we returned to most of all. And The Man with the Golden Gun was one of those that we returned to. And it was probably for all the set pieces, the brilliant villain, the setting, the music, all things that became really, really familiar to us. So I have it in my memory really, really fondly. But as is good with this podcast, and as you kind of always do with Bond films, you watch them and you rewatch them, and when you rewatch them, you've got kind of a different mind, different, you know, you look at things differently. And as you mature, you try to be perhaps a bit more critical. The Man with the Golden Gun probably serves up a few things that you can be critical of, I think. You perhaps wouldn't choose to, I wouldn't perhaps choose to do as the writer and possibly the director. But at the same time, whilst also trying to be mature about it, I've also got to stop being so mature about it and, you know, look at it for its enjoyment value and for the reaction I get from it, watching each scene, and following the story and engaging with the characters, and I still really, really like it. It still holds up for those reasons. So I'm perfectly willing to accept that it's flawed, it's faulted, but I still really, really enjoy watching it.
I think I'll hold off from asking where you put it in your recent View to a Trill rankings, because we'll save that for the end, because who knows, it might have, by the time we've discussed it, it might have even gone up or down since you did that quiz. Chris, just in terms of growing up, when did you first watch it?
I was a kid. I can't remember exactly when I watched it, or where it kind of falls in, you know, watching the other films. Excuse me. But I loved it as a kid. I thought, I loved the fact that the villain has a gun that he builds, you know, that he is essentially, you know, as he says, kind of 007's equal. They're very similar in what they do. I loved Christopher Lee, you know, having kind of grown up with him and in a lot of, you know, obviously horror film, Hammer horror films and stuff like that.
Shouldn't have been watching them. You shouldn't have been watching.
But yeah, it was always I always really liked it. I think similar to Harry, I think watching it again now, it doesn't flow. It's a bit disjointed at times, but there are some scenes where I think Roger looks a bit uncomfortable with this, and I can understand why. But you know, it's still a solid Bond film. I can't remember where I listed it, but it's certainly not one that I pass over very often. It's always one that I've always enjoyed. And I think to be honest with you, I think watching it this time, I enjoyed it more than Live and Let Die.
Ooh,
and I don't know if that's because of John Barry's music, and because John Barry's music for me always elevates the film. You can have an okay Bond film, but when it's scored by him, it's magical. And I think that's the big difference between that and Live and Let Die for me is Barry's score.
If I remember, Chris, I think it was your top three: Honor Majesty's, From Russia with Love, and The Living Daylights.
Yeah,
because they're all unbelievable Barry scores, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there you go. This score was, I've had many arguments with people even in this household about, you know, the theme song, and I stand firm on, you know, on that, and it's a score I listen to it again and again. It's one that I've in past kind of since doing this podcast and listened to a lot more kind of Bond things, that it's definitely that score that stands out for me as a highlight for Barry.
Gorgeous. Math, what were your views growing up of this film?
So, if I remember rightly, we had it on video and then it might have got a bit taped over or something. So there was a period when we didn't have it for a while. And so, when we went on holiday, I think we went to Florida on holiday. I don't know why it took us to go to Florida to get a video copy of it. But
we did.
And we also got Star Wars A New Hope, and that was the first time I'd seen that. But anyway, when we came back, in our video recorder, it would only play it black and white. I don't know why.
Such a good memory.
So it took me a bit to have, although I had some familiarity with the film, it took quite a while for me to be as familiar as I am with other films. Having said that, I was still, you know, a child, so, you know, I've got fond memories of watching it. In terms of, I know, you know, we said we won't go into rankings necessarily, but it's actually, I just checked, it sits just below Skyfall in my rankings.
Oh,
so,
God.
You were
a defender.
I would say with both of them, in different ways, I enjoy watching both of them, and I like, you know, if I saw that one was, either of those was on, I would continue watching it, you know. Unless I had something else planned, in which case I might change. But I think this one, I really like loads of things about it. I think one of the reasons I've never felt I'd ever put it right up there is perhaps because of, and I'll bore you with this all the time, every time I'm on here, it's just the overall lack of a big scheme that the villain's doing it. But that might be because I've never really watched it and tried to understand what the energy crisis is and Soek's agitator and everything. But you know what I mean? There's nothing I'm not quite sure what Bond's trying to thwart, but maybe you guys can enlighten me on that. So I find it a really enjoyable one. There are films, probably, particularly something like Casino Royale, where I can see that that's probably like a better made film and everything, but something like this I would enjoy watching more and be more likely to put it on.
John?
No, I mean, my experience with this film was, I think I said last time about The Spy Who Loved Me, when I said I was into it, my mum bought me The Spy Who Loved Me for Christmas. She also bought me The Man with the Golden Gun. So they were the first two Bond films that I owned. And growing up, me and my brother David, we absolutely loved this film. This was, I would probably say, especially like as a 10-year-old, if anybody asked me, what's your favourite Bond film? I'd probably say that because I watched it the most. And yet, about 5 years ago, we went back through doing the films, and we were trying to get, David was trying to get his girlfriend into watching Bond films, and she was loving them. I mean, she's a massive Connery fan. So they went through chronologically, and she was loving the Connery film. And I was desperately trying to get Rachel into them. And we watched it one night together as a four. Alex and Rachel just tore this film apart. And they're just like, I'm sorry, but that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And I sat there, and I was like, yeah, you're right. And they had this horrific experience with it that I was just like, wow, this is a really... It has, I think Matt's spot on where he says there's great parts to it. Because there are. There's little moments where you can really enjoy. But when you take a step back, you go, oh my word, this isn't... It's less than the sum of its parts by quite a long way. Having watched it again recently, I enjoy it. I'm not going to be slating it, saying it's a horrible watch or anything. It's in that same camp as Diamonds Are Forever, mate. I enjoy it.
Quite literally the same camp.
Yeah. But there's certain decisions that are made, there's certain plot points, there's certain strands, and I think the energy crisis is very much one of them, that I look back and I go, if I want to look at this critically, which when I do look at my rankings, that's what I do go off. I think, no, I'm not sure about that. But I certainly don't hate the film. I don't think it's a great film, but it's enjoyable. That's probably where I'm at with this film.
Fair, John. Stephen, when we were discussing which of these review episodes you'd like to come on board on, this was one of the first films you named, so I'm hoping you're a big fan of it.
I am. A big fan of it. Always have been. This was one of the ones that when I did my first rewatch in a few years, I still really liked, and it held up for me. And I completely agree with what John was saying there, that I've read a lot of criticism about this film, because what I like to do is, when I see a film that I enjoy and people are tearing it apart, I quite like to look at the reasons why they dislike it and then think, okay, right, let's see if I'm missing something here. Same with if someone really likes a film that I hate, I'll see, right, why did they like it and what have I missed? Like I was saying earlier, when I read all these really sort of negative opinions from Bond Twitter about The Man with the Golden Gun, it being down the bottom of a lot of rankings, I looked into why. And I even spoke to a few people and said, why is it you hate it so much? Then I went back and watched it. And a lot of the criticisms I can't really deny. I mean, you wouldn't deny someone's criticisms. Everyone's criticisms are valid. But a lot of the things that they were pointing out, I thought, yeah, you're right. The plot is a bit of a mess. This scene doesn't make sense. This scene doesn't make sense. This bit doesn't connect. I think that when it comes to Bond films, we've all got the different boxes that we want ticked. We've all got specific things that we need to see. And we all have different preferences. Personally, I quite like the smaller scale Bond films and the ones with a little bit of a darker tone. I can absolutely see why, if you love Roger and you know you want smooth Roger, you want charming Roger, then this is not going to be the film for you. I quite like it when Roger leans into the dark side of Bond, because I think he's really good at it. I mean, obviously, he's great at the one-liners. We know he can do the one-liners, and you know he can walk across the dance floor with huge flares that enter the room before he does, and he can just wink at a woman. He can do all that. But I love it when he'll kill someone in a dark way, like when he shoots the kid and Octopussy in the forehead, or when he kicks Locke's car over the cliff. I know that you read these stories and everything you read says Roger hated doing that, Roger hated doing that, and Roger hated doing that, and you know he wouldn't run up the stairs, and fair enough, I still think he's really good at it. And The Man with the Golden Gun is probably his darkest performance. I'd say it's even darker than For Your Eyes Only. But I still like watching him in it. I still think he's got enough charm so that he's not dislikable. And at the end of the day, Bond is a brutal killer. He is a bastard. If you read the books, he's a snobby, cold-blooded bastard. Roger just brings that likability to him. I think when you watch the Roger films over and over, you almost forget that he's supposed to be a brutal, cold-hearted assassin, because Roger is so charming. So when you watch The Man with the Golden Gun and he leans into that side of it, it's a bit jarring. I can imagine someone, if this was your first Roger film, you'd be a bit like, ooh, okay, didn't see this coming from his reputation. For me, it does enough of the things that I like that I can forgive the things that are wrong with it. And there is a lot wrong with it, but I'm sure we'll get into that.
Normally, we might go over what we think about the actor in the film, but I think I know everyone's opinions on Roger Moore, and it's a bit of an odd question because, like I say, in this film, it's not really the same Roger Moore who's in, say, Octopussy, which is the other the other one we've done so far. So we'll discuss Roger's performance as we go along, because there are some unusual decisions made, perhaps by the director. Or...
Hi, I'm Rob.
I'm Simon.
And I'm James.
We want to talk about those movies. Those supposedly bad movies. Those movies that bombed.
To see if they weren't that bad after all, join us every week on the For Your Reconsideration podcast, part of the Flickering Myth podcast network.
You can catch us on iTunes, on Spotify, and all the usual streaming apps.
And it won't cost you a solitary bean, mate.
It's like it's free.
It's just like it's free.
Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman intended to follow You Only Live Twice with this film and Roger Moore in the role, because of course Sean Connery said that was going to be his last film then. They even had Cambodia set as the planned location to film in, but then the Somlout uprising, I'm told, made that impractical, and then the delay meant they shifted to Honor Majesty's Secret Service instead. Then of course, I'm not sure why Roger didn't do it, I'm sure people will tell us, but it was of course decided that George Lazenby would do that. After that film and Sean's return ended in Diamonds Are Forever, it was decided to finally film Golden Gun in Southeast Asia. So they'd already sort of made that decision, I think, before they'd even started filming Live and Let Die. The story is loosely based on the 1965 Ian Fleming novel of the same name, which was actually the first novel released after his death, about a year after he died. It's largely set in Jamaica, the novel, so because the previous film had been in Jamaica and we'd already been there in Doctor No, again, the producers thought, we don't really need to see that again, we're trying to show these exotic locales, so they shifted it to the Far East. Part of the film is set in Beirut, so location scouting was initially done for Iran, because they didn't really think there was much going on in Beirut that was filmable, and it would have been obviously quite a difficult place to do. But again, even Iran had to be stopped because of something called the Yom Kippur War. So there seems to be a lot of conflicts going on wherever they tried to start. Now, production designer Peter Merton, he suggested Phuket Bay purely from looking at pictures of the place. That was it, I think. And this prompted the producers to say, oh, that looks absolutely amazing, let's relocate to Thailand, which now, I mean, we think of it as a pretty standard go-to Western tourist destination, well, for Westerners. But at the time, it's a pretty remote location, especially the island, Scaramanga's Island, where I don't know whether anyone had been before. So it was, again, groundbreaking James Bond location at the time. Also, though, of course, the film is set in the face of the 1973 energy crisis. Again, this is not a history lesson, but I hadn't a clue. Don't really know an awful lot about that. And Britain apparently hadn't fully recovered from that by the time of the release of the film a year later. The other elements that are involved in this film, John, of course, has already mentioned them in a previous episode. Perhaps the mid-70s sort of slew of martial arts and kung fu films, which might have had a slight impact on one or two of the scenes, particularly one big set piece, extended set piece. So, Mank, good old Mank, Tom Mankiewicz, not the original one, but we won't go into the David Finch film now. We're all friends here now, so we don't really want to go into that. As if I've seen it, honestly. Anyway, Tom Mankiewicz, he did the first draft, and he came up with the idea of pitting Bond and Scaramanga against each other in a battle of wills. I'd say this is arguably the first of the has Bond finally met his match opponents, because both were criminal masterminds and a physical threat. Maybe you disagree. I know there's Donald Grant, perhaps, but he's not the criminal mastermind. It's not his scheme, is it? He's a paid assassin, effectively. I think Zorin is possibly one, which would come later. Although physically, I'm not sure. Not really sure. Yeah, fair enough, yeah. And then obviously we get Alex Trevelyan, we get Renard, but obviously the twist was that he wasn't the main mastermind, and Raoul Silver. So you could argue that really Scaramanga, Trevelyan and Silver are the sort of trilogy of physical threats that could actually take on Bond, as well as be criminal masterminds. Matthew?
Yeah, just on that point, I think I remember reading that one of the reasons they changed from Donald Pleasance to Telly Savalas for Honor Majesty's Secret Service was to make him more of a physical threat. So he could perhaps say, even though, you know, it's the same character as has been, you know, Blofeld through various films. Perhaps that one is one where he's both a physical threat and a, you know, obviously clearly intellectual criminal mastermind. So I was just going to chuck him, particularly in that film. Because then again, we get to Charles Grey and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. The Telesavalas Blofeld and even Kananga, they're probably decent physical threat. But they've all got henchmen, haven't they? They've got people to do that sort of thing for them.
I've never understood that. Can someone talk me through the Kananga knife thing? That always, I think, that's weird. So odd.
I like it.
It's unusual. It's sort of that whole 70s mysterious...
Yeah, with a bit of a giggle as well.
Yeah, the Baron Samedi. It's all a bit scary. But anyway, back to this film. But really, apart from, like I say, Trevelyan and Silver, Scaramanga's the only sort of one who comes up in that ilk. And of course, we don't see him fight Silver, another dig. So we get that great, great, underrated, I think. People don't seem to mention it enough, the Trevelyan fight scene in the crater, the satellite dish. I mean, that's a terrific fight, isn't it? This, of course, we don't see a fist fight. We have a duel, a classic duel. Tensions between Mank and Guy Hamilton led to Richard Maybaum yet again delivering a draft. Of course, he'd written pretty much every Bond film from the beginning until License to Kill, I think, was his last one. He sidelined the duality of Bond and Scaramanga somewhat, because I think that it was going on a bit. And even though it is one of the main themes in the film, he sidelined it in favour of this Solex MacGuffin. And Michael G. Wilson was tasked with researching solar power to adapt it to the plot. So I think this is one of the first times he was directly involved with the screenwriting. Because as we've mentioned, I think it was Dick Maybaum and him, Ray co-wrote all of the 80s, the John Glenn film. A bit like Purvis and Wade deserve credit for The World Is Not Enough. Certainly at least Michael G. Wilson was onto the task back then. Just before we get to Guy Hamilton, the cinematographer Ted Moore, he'd shot all the previous films apart from You Only Live Twice and Honor Majesties, which possibly the best shot films of the ones that have been done to that day. He actually, this was his last Bond film, and he stopped due to illness when they'd done all the location shoots. And he was replaced with a guy called Oswald Morris. I'll be honest, I didn't know an awful lot about this guy. But he has got 3 Oscar nominations for cinematography, for Oliver, which I think it's come up a couple of times now, I'm not sure why. The Wiz, yeah? The Motown version, the musical of The Wizard of Oz, that got a nomination for cinematography. And Fiddler on the Roof, which he won an Oscar for. You know, we say on the new films, they sort of keep bringing in these Oscar-winning people. They were doing back then.
Was that the one with Topol?
Yes, yeah. Good connection. Good Bond connection. He's also, other notable films he'd done, some absolute crackers again here. Moby Dick, the Gregory Peck one. Lolita, the Kubrick one, not the brilliant remake with Jeremy Irons. You know, The Hill Upon Which I Will Die. Oswald Morris did The Hill. of course, the link there, not just Sean Connery, but Chris Goldie, one of his favourite films. Sidney Lumet film, yeah. Other ones he did, Goodbye Mr. Chips, slightly different. Which The Albert Finney Scrooge, which I did manage to see over Christmas, yeah. Sleuth, not the remake. I've only seen the remake, actually, with Jude Law and Michael Caine, isn't it? Caine's in the original, isn't he?
Christopher Reeve,
yeah, he played a different part.
Laurence Olivier.
Four.
What am I thinking of? Doesn't matter.
Is that Night, what's it called? I know what you mean. Christopher Reeve's Michael Caine. Night. Oh, that's another one. I'm going to remember it like 1 in the morning.
Rob will be Googling.
I know the one you're thinking of. Yeah. Just,
Yeah, other films he did, just 3 more, you know, it's an exhaustive list, but... the Odessa File, another Michael Caine, all linked. I think that was that an Eon, Saltzman and Broccoli. Also, The Man Who Would Be King, again, Caine and Connery. Saw it recently, wasn't it? Didn't really do it for me. And his last film was The Dark Crystal.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Ooh. Bit of a change there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well shot, though.
So. Oh, beautiful.
What a guy to come in for this. So enough about him and Ted Moore. We'll go on to Guy Hamilton, the director. So Mervyn Ian Guy Hamilton, as of course you all know him as. He'd obviously done 3 previous Bond films. He'd done Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever, and Live and Let Die. So I've seen Calvin Dyson's video of rating all the directors. I don't think he rates him particularly highly, but these are pretty
third.
Four. Okay, well, yeah.
Pretty many, reasonable.
Out of how many? 7? Anyway, yeah. no, I'm just being a... Yeah. Yeah, so he's done four pretty famous films, I'd say, hasn't he, in the Bond canon. Pretty iconic films. Very controversial and divisive, some of them are. Especially Goldfinger. I keep seeing criticisms of it on Twitter. I cannot understand it. I'm getting fed up with it, clearly. Anyway, we will discuss Guy Hamilton probably maybe more in a Goldfinger episode. I didn't realise, though, he turned down Dr. No. We've started off the whole... The only things he said about this film that I could garner were that he said he instructed Roger Moore not to mimic Connery. Well,
that is,
I think,
strange.
Roger Moore might say it in a different way around.
Yeah. But,
wow. Yeah.
Out of the four films he'd done, Bond films, this is the only one he regretted making. So how depressing is that?
It seems a bit strange. There's a recurring trend then, because I'm sure Lulu says that she doesn't rate her own theme tune, and John Barry says the score was one of his least favourite.
Yeah.
Tell me that Guy Hamilton didn't like the film. It's just...
I'm sure you've probably got something on this, Tom, but it's pretty well known that around this time there's a massive bust-up between Saltzman and Broccoli, isn't there? And the whole production around it isn't great. And you just wonder if, like, it was just an unhappy place to work at.
I actually, reading around it, apparently Saltzman and Broccoli were almost taking in turns to produce each film. Like, what, you do this one, I'll do the next one, which is so odd. So that does suggest that things weren't going on very well. But yeah, that's a shame. Yeah, like I say, we'll go into more detail on him on future episodes, but he was a bit of a James Bond figure again, a bit like Terence Young, having served in the Royal Navy. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, so if you know, for heroism. A couple of films he was meant to direct but turned down or couldn't do due to scheduling conflicts. Just Superman and Batman. I mean, come on, 1989, bringing out Guy Hamilton. I presume that was way before it actually got made, you know, because it will have taken many forms, wouldn't it? Right, John.
It was written by Mankiewicz, because obviously.
Yes, it was
Superman.
Yeah, Superman link. Yeah, correct. Yeah. Can the man do any wrong?
Superman.
Yeah, very hard. Come on. Well done.
Batman. Yes.
Yeah.
No.
A few of us are Manx here as well, aren't we? Yeah. I think, in fact, that was Steven's joke on Twitter, so I will credit my sources.
Was it?
I'm pretty sure.
I don't remember making
well,
that.
Well, okay.
I'll take the credit. Yeah, fine. Yeah.
Take it.
Steven, just for your benefit, we always do a quiz every single film that we do. It's five questions, and we see who wins that round. The way that we do it is I'll ask a question, and we will have a buzzer that is relevant to that round, to this film. Whoever answers the buzzer first means that they can answer the question, and we'll see who gets the win. I think at the moment, I think it's neck and neck between Chris and Math at the top, I think, possibly, which is quite good. So it was between one or two things, but I think it would be more entertaining. The buzzer we're going to have today is, I want to hear three, Jula, if I hear that,
super,
you know,
very good job.
So, question one: what 00 number was Bill Fairbanks?
Jula.
That's Chris. Chris's dulcet tones there.
002
is correct. Yeah,
Chris loves his 00 agents.
I do.
Yeah.
Okay. Question two. Which Secret Service first recruited and trained Scaramanga?
Jula.
Harry?
Yeah? That was just so real lack of confidence in that. Is it KGB?
It was the KGB, yes. Yeah.
Jula!
Yeah!
Jula!
Question three. What occupation did Scaramanga's mother have?
Jula.
Go on, I want two more, Stephen, if that's all right.
Jula.
Go on, what is it?
It's completely went out of my head now. The third
Jula.
Took away. No, someone else goes, go on.
Jula.
Go on, Harry.
You say his mum?
Yeah.
I know the British Snake Charmer.
Correct.
Opposed to an Italian snake.
Well,
is the son of Cuban?
Cuban circus ringmaster is his dad. And then
Harry, this could be the first point. This could be the first win, man.
Yeah, who'd have thought? How embarrassing for the rest of you.
All green Rolls Royces in Hong Kong belong to which hotel?
Chula. Chula.
Go on, Thomas.
The Peninsula Hotel.
Correct.
My best Swedish accent. Or could have been Nicky Van Zyl, who dubbed her.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be a bit harsh on this last one. I want, if you answer it and you don't have it on them all, or you answer them correctly, you're going to lose a point. So,
okay. Harry, stay silent.
Yeah, absolutely.
What four items make up the golden
Chula,
gun?
Chula.
Oh, go on, Stephen.
So it's a lighter, a cigarette case, a cufflink and a pen.
Whoa.
Spot on.
Very good.
4 points, John.
It's not, no. So, Harry Pickup gets his first victory of the Really 007 season.
Get in there! Chula! Well done, Stephen. I always forget, though, the cufflink being the trigger. I always forget that.
Yeah.
Which I think is so good, isn't it?
It's gorgeous, isn't it, that?
So good.
So if you see him going around with a loose cuff.
Yeah, one missing, like, always. And, and if he's made love. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Such a quotable, brilliant film. Right?
Mm.
We've got to the film. Seems a bit previous, doesn't it?
Yeah, wow.
It's a bit like the opposite of flying a plane when they say, we'll make up time in the air. We'll lose some time. Right, straight into the gun barrel sequence. I'm told it's the first one to drop the pluck guitar.
I did read that it's his last one in the last gun barrel sequence in a business suit. The rest are all tuxedos from that point on. Does that seem right to you? Yeah.
The flares can't remain, can they?
I think they. I've always thought that they were the same from Few Rides Only onwards, are they? Or is a spy onwards?
Is he not wheeled in on A View to a Kill?
Very good.
Oi.
Yeah. Less of that. Yeah. It's quite a fast. Lovely fast beat, isn't it? The theme when it comes in. Yeah, so John Barry, we'll touch on him over the whole thing, but this was his first Roger Moore film, of course. First Roger Moore Bond film. And it's like, from now on, he goes into the more much more horns-based stuff rather than the sort of 60s beat, you know, kind of, yeah, like you say, heavy on the guitar. And I just, you know, the guy just gets better and better, possibly, for me. Especially with these Bond scores. Not to say that, you know, the early ones aren't that good. I mean, dear me. They're incredible, aren't they? But George Martin in Live and Let Die did everything it needed to do, and it's pretty underrated. Particularly, I don't know how much of a composer he is, but anyway. I know John's more of a Beatles man, and we'll go into that in that episode. But
well, we were talking off-air just now about how I just can't see the series without John Barry. Even a film like this, where he himself said he didn't rate it, he thought it was one of his least effective scores. I love that little, I'm not sure what you'd call it, a cue or a refrain, maybe the little five-note thing that he does throughout the film, you know, the da-da-da-da-da, and then it every time you hear that, I think, yes, I'm up for this action scene. It's a little bit repetitive, but I don't care because I love it that much, just...
And unique to the film as well.
Yeah.
Do you know how long he had to compose this soundtrack?
Was it 3 weeks, Harry?
3 weeks.
3 weeks, he had. 3 weeks to get it wrapped up.
Absolutely
to compose all that music, record it, and make it fit the film.
Well, just for the Funhouse could take months, couldn't it? I mean,
yeah. Different breed, isn't it?
Yeah, so my main thoughts about the score, I really like the melody. I think there's a lot of use of the theme tune and in different places. And I think it's quite good in terms of like the, I like the string theme and the, especially with like Scaramanga and Missandei's, I love all that. You can tell it's rushed. It's more in places where the score isn't there as opposed to the score itself. I think of some of the action scenes, and I think of there's very little intensity in the two action scenes, such as the boat chase and the car chase. I think that they would benefit from a more intense score. I mean, if you think of like there's bits in it where it goes and it feels like that should kick on and to bring in the theme, but it doesn't. And I think that stuff like the car loop, which is a phenomenal stunt, would just really benefit from some James Bond theme in it. I understand that in Live and Let Die, there was no Bond theme. There was no score even throughout the boat chase. But that was because it was a deliberately long-winded boat chase that you could build up tension with. Both those action scenes in The Man with the Golden Gun are short and fast-paced, and I think they need a score to go with them that actually complements that. But in terms of the actual score and listening to it, I really like it. It's one that I can certainly listen to on its own, probably more than actually in the film, but I just think with a bit more time and a bit more polish, it could have been even more effective within the film.
Those are the opening submissions from the prosecution lawyer, John Kell.
I was just going to say, it reminds me of Thunderball in that way, that it's quite repetitive, that it's the same themes you hear throughout the film. Thunderball's a bit like that as well. It's the same stuff again and again and again. And I suppose if you like it, it's not a big deal. But if you, once you do notice it, you think, yeah, that's the same thing. And I've heard that again, and I've heard that again. But
with that, I think he's almost an author of his own misfortune. And especially when you've seen them many times in Thunderball, how many different themes are there? There's maybe like four main themes. There's the Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. There's the title theme. There's the... how many themes were there in Skyfall and Spectre? If you just do cues, which are just to do with the individual C, that aren't memorable, no one will say, oh, that was a repetitive score.
There's something that I've been trying to put my finger on with John Barry for years, and it's like, He makes the sound of something. And what I mean by that is, when you watch Thunderbolt, he makes the sound of underwater. I can't really get any better than that.
Yeah, no,
I agree. Same with, if I went to Vegas and I didn't hear the theme tune from I'd be a bit disappointed.
Yeah.
That's the same with...
Whenever you go, when you go skiing, on a Majesty's theme.
Yeah.
Not that everyone goes skiing, that wasn't... I haven't been many times in my life.
He just has this way of capturing the feeling of what you think it will be like. I mean, I'm never going to go to space, but I imagine I know what it's going to sound like now.
Tim, I've got his name there. Tim Peake. He must have had that on his Walkman on the way into space.
What do you go with, though? Do you go with Space Capsule from We Only Live Twice, or do you go with the one from Moonraker where he's shooting down the globes? Which one?
I think Fly Into Space for me. Possibly the greatest piece he's ever written. But we'll get on to its rivals in this film.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying, John. In terms of, there are certain breaks in the film where it's silent. That was one of the criticisms of Live and Let Die, the boat chase, wasn't it? That was totally unscored. Part of the reason they did that was because the sound of those engines, of those amazing cars... and the sort of the Bangkok hustle and bustle. I'm only guessing here now, but just to really emphasise the power of the engines and the realism of that scene. You cold, John? You wrapping up one there?
There is this sense, though. Interestingly, though, we said at the start, we were impressed and wowed that only 5 months later they began shooting. But now there's this suggestion, and I don't know what my opinion is on it, that perhaps the soundtrack, could have done with more time. And, there was quarrelling behind the scenes, and I'm sure there were some decisions that were actually taken out of John Barry's hands with regard to some things. And then there's like complaints that the release poster was just a rehash of Live and Let Die. Was it perhaps too quickly released, the film? Is that Is that perhaps
I imagine
that is something, because of course it was then the biggest gap between, you know, the, at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that the biggest gap? Oh no, it's equal.
Yeah, it was. No, it was the biggest.
Spy was 77, I think.
Yeah. That might have part of them into the legal stuff but, as well, yeah. But it's weird, there's loads of films though, aren't there, with it was last minute productions, and you know, and like even Die Hard, you know, I was reading about that. There's loads of sort of last minute changes and things, and didn't realise that it was going to turn out well until the edit. And
yeah,
From Russia with Love, in our review,
we talked about all the things where they had to U-turn on decisions and change their minds on set there and then, and it worked out for the better. But perhaps some people can see it more in this film than others.
Like Peter Hunt accidentally, because of a rush, inventing incredible new editing techniques. It's incredible. That was amazing.
Yeah.
We're making up time. Sorry, we're losing time.
Gosh.
So the pre-title sequence, I'm going to put it out there. I think it's one of the best in the entire series. James Bond isn't in it. Another one of those. Chris, in terms of that opening shot, I think they wanted to sort of just show that it's drawing the viewer into the sort of exotic world.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's one of the best in my opinion, but it really does sort of grab you. And
how does that grab you? Sorry.
There's a lot of, you know, straight off, because you know, you've got Christopher Lee, you know, obviously Moore Adams, you've got this great setup. It's like, well, what's happening here? Why is he giving him money for? Why is he trying to kill it? You know, when I remember as a kid thinking, "Well, what was happening?" It was quite confusing. You know, Christopher Lee looks ace in his tracksuit. The music is great, and the the way as the scene changes, and you got the fun house element. The way that he goes from like cowboy kind of, you know, kind of theme tunes to, you know, gangsters and all that. It's so much fun. And then the fun house with the, it just throws you completely. You got the wonky sets, you know, almost like the Hall of Mirrors in, you know, like Lady from Shanghai. You know, there's a kind of, it just straight off, who's, you know, with what's the guy? He, obviously, if you've seen Diamonds Are Forever,
Mark Lawrence.
You think you'd hang on a minute? I thought, what, is that the same? Is that the same character? You know,
same character.
So, I think it is great. Because it is confusing and you are expecting, where's Bond? Oh, there he is. Roger Moore with a tash being as a gunfighter. You know, is that, you know, and then having the reveal with the sort of the mannequin, you know, waxwork version of him. It is a great opening. And it's not the kind of traditional, you know, obviously later on, the big stunts kind of set piece of, you know, this is, you know, his first mission. It's, look at this guy, look how effective he is, look at what a great assassin he is. You want to know more about him. And that bit when he clicks the button, you know, puts his hand on the button and the stairs turn and he slides down.
I can't.
He flips, grabs the gun and shoots him.
I can't.
You know, you would be clapping, wouldn't you? You know, that is a brilliant opening. And then to turn and there's, like I say, that waxwork of Bond and he shoots all his fingers off. It is a great opening.
I think if you stopped and you were like completely cold and critical about that part, if you just say you had an elevated position and you could look at the funhouse and you would say, well, he's going to see Scar. How can he not see Scaramanga? He's like 2 feet away from him. Why is he not shooting him? And then, hold on. He knows what Bond looks like. He's got a statue of Bond.
So many things
you could pick at. But it's just, as you say, it's just awesome when he slides down the steps and then does the little roll. And then I love when he shoots the four fingers off. It's completely unnecessary. You just think to yourself, how much did you pay for that statue? I bet you commissioned someone. I bet that took ages for you to make. And you've just blown off four fingers for no reason. It's just immensely cool. And I think, as you were saying, the purpose of it is clearly to say, this guy is an elite assassin. He's got an awesome aim. And it works from that. For me, it achieves its aim.
I equally love it. And there's certain parallels you can also make with From Russia with Love, where there's, you know, there's an assassin out there who's got Bond as his trophy, and there's like this admiration, this idea of wanting to challenge himself, which I love. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, it's one of the first villains that could be an equal competitor to Bond, and you see that in this opening sequence. You, you want to follow this guy, you want to follow this character, Christopher Lee's character, through the film. You want to see how he develops and how he evolves. It's a really good introduction to him, which is great. I mean, there's sort of kind of similar tones to Diamonds Are Forever about it. It's got a little bit of that eeriness. Obviously, the Shady Tree guy, but just the soundtrack and there's a little bit of eeriness. And even, you know, like the Golden Gun is like in a crow or in a raven. Or there's something just a little bit weird about, I don't know. And it's those things that just make you feel a little bit unsettled. And I'll be honest, I know I've seen criticisms like Essential Bond, the book, goes in hard on this film, and it says, you know, as soon as you see a waxwork of James Bond, you just know that in the finale Bond's gonna pose as that. I'm gonna be honest, and obviously I was young, I never thought that, so when I watched that as a child I didn't have those thoughts. But I don't know, what Math, what are you thinking?
I think even if you think that, what's wrong with that? I like this opening is, you know, so some of the Bond films, the opening is completely separate, maybe a one-off mission. Some of them, it sets up the sort of plot of the film or the scheme of the villain or something like that. This one presents you with the character of the villain, which is really interesting. Mm. And I think if you, you know, maybe it's because I've watched it, I'm almost going to say the opposite of you, Harry, that, like, it's saying this guy is going to go one-on-one with Scaramanga, and, look, he comes up completely short against this unbelievable guy who doesn't even have a weapon, and then, you know, he's able to shoot him with one bullet. And that guy who's had loads of chances. Interestingly, I don't know why the silencer doesn't, do more of a. but anyway, so I think even if you do take what the Essential Bond is saying there, good. Like, it's building up. Like, Bond's going to have to go through all that in order to, you know, or he might have to go through all that or some of it in order to get the better of this unbelievable opponent.
Yeah, my thoughts on the start, the opening scene, I think it's really good. I really like it. I know that Bond isn't there, but actually it's really entertaining. I know Rob's not here, so I think we just need to give a quick shout out to the first time we see Nick Knack. He is carrying a bottle of Tabasco sauce. I think it really sets up Chase. It's very intense, the fight between Rodney and Scaramanga. It gives this whole new world, which is of intrigue, and I think that's brilliant. I think we see a lot of good stuff between Nick Knack and Scaramanga there. I think we realise that Nick Knack isn't necessarily loyal to Scaramanga. They have a respect for each other, but they would quite happily stab him in the back if he needs to. And Scaramanga actually uses that as motivation. He wants Nick Knack to get the best assassins around to test him. He's happy to put his life at risk with that. I think it's a fantastic, imaginative gun duel. My one frustration with it is actually the use of Bond at the end, the model. Not that I have a problem with Bond being a model there, not that I think about the logistics of how did they get that there, or anything of the sort like that. More that it is setting up a plot that this film is going to be about Scaramanga wanting to kill Bond. And unfortunately for the film, it doesn't go down this route. If it did, I think this would be a much better film. I think that there is a lot of mystery and a lot of intrigue, and we are set up to think that this film is about Scaramanga wants a duel with Bond to see who the best assassin is. And actually, it's none of that stuff, because that bullet was sent by Miss Anders. And instead, they have to crowbar in this energy crisis plot that seems to come very left field out of nowhere and just seems to be a bit of a token aspect to the film, when really what we're interested in is Bond versus Scaramanga. And I actually think that whole aspect could be superfluous. We could have just got rid of it. And the film would have been far, far stronger if it was just a game of cat and mouse between the two.
Yeah, we will get, when we get to the first M scene, it is almost like it's a coincidence, of course, it's meant to be. I didn't realise this, that Bond's other mission that he was keen to do is to do with the energy thing, and actually they're both connected. Yeah, if we're going to be critical like we were Skyfall, you could say that's ridiculous, what are the chances, fair enough. But anyway, we will get to that. But
yeah, no, I think John's right in what he says, and he's also right to point out the intrigue with this character, Nick Knack, his role in the film and his relationship with Scaramanga. What does Nick Knack want? Throughout the whole film, you never really know what Nick Nat wanted. Although when I was reading up about it, there were some sort of parallels made with his character and someone from Pink Panther who I'm not familiar with, but someone who the villain purposely employs to recruit people to test him. So it's like, although Nick Nack maybe does want these people to beat Scaramanga, but I think that's why he's hired. It's Nick Nack's job to find these people who will run Scaramanga really close to the wire. So I don't know what Nick Nack, it still doesn't make it clear what Nick Nack wants from these challenges. But I think Scaramanga wants Nick Nack to put the toughest opponents in front of him. He wants the challenge.
Again, from an artistic point of view, there's 6'5" Christopher Lee, and then you've got, was it 3'11" Herve Villacher. Well, it's deliberate, isn't it? He's pretty much twice the size of the guy. In the henchman episode, which Stephen was on, it's like, is Nick Nack a henchman? Sort of in his general day-to-day business, but he's not, is he? He's not a physical threat at all, because Christopher Lee is the physical threat, Scaramanga's the physical threat, and he's just got him there as the dog's body end to do the dirty work, to do the hard work. Just to go back a bit, because we really are going to massive detail on this this opening, especially. Yeah, so Nick Nack, first of all, we see him carrying the champagne. I have to mention, before, the most gorgeous tracksuit, lovely ice white swimming shorts from Scaramanga. Watching one of the documentaries about the making of it, apparently, because Christopher Lee is quite a fairly pale guy, they had to just, because if he lives in Thailand, he should have a massive tan, shouldn't he? Anyway, so he was painted every day, like spray tanned or whatever, yeah. And then it had to be washed off every day. Apparently, so. Interesting.
Very.
It's just so, like, we will go through it. So, and it's a bit like what John says. It's like isolated bits of the most iconic visions and images and scenes and stunts. It's just, I understand the criticism, maybe the getting it all together into a coherent story and thread and consistent tone and all that. But that, I mean, that's so iconic already. You know, the Anders swimsuit, it's pretty iconic. I don't know, it's just, you know, growing up seeing all these things. I know John is a fan of this character, so we'll hear more about that.
If you had a wish, you could pick one tracksuit: Scaramanga's tracksuit or Roger's Velour from A View to a Kill.
Both for men in the 50s. Yeah, clearly.
Debenhams are selling them.
Yeah. Might be closed by the time. By the time this is released, it probably would have been done and dusted for months.
You've got to mention the setting as well, yes, of this. Yeah. This opening scene, because like Matt said, when we had it as a video, eventually we got it on video from America, and in England it would only show in black and white, but to actually see it in colour, it's such a vibrant welcome, isn't it? It's an unbelievable setting and completely real.
Yeah, it's like I said, Thailand and that area of the world wasn't very well known at all to Western audiences. So you've got the iconic shot with the Mushroom Island, which is now known as James Bond Island because of all the tourists. And Harry, you've been.
I have, correct, yeah. I don't know if I'm the only one here, but yeah.
No wonder you love this.
For my honeymoon, we went to Phuket. So. but we did venture out, and you know, there are loads of leaflets out there, you know, visit James Bond Island. And it's got that, you know, what it looks like all over the leaflet. So that even this setting, I think, even to the most casual of Bond fans, this setting is a poster in itself. It entices people, and tourists go to it. And when we went, you know, it was absolutely flooded with, you know, it wasn't the authentic experience. There's like a beach that you walk out onto, and then you can see that island in front of you. And because the water's not that deep, you can walk out reasonably close to it. But there were tourists, you know, from around the world, all nationalities coming to see it, and it was kind of an incredible reminder of how far the legend spreads, pretty much, of James Bond. And to say, you know, this is one of the films that's not so well regarded.
A flop.
You know, there. Yes. But yet, this one setting alone, and you know, it's not a set, it's not an incredibly designed set, it's a perfectly picked setting, isn't it? It's really remarkable.
The name I've got here, I don't know what I'm saying, like Kokau Pinkham. But of course, now James Bond Island.
James Bond Island.
We'll go with that.
Phuket in those days was a very small native village with a very small landing strip, very small, cut out of the jungle. And we flew down there from Bangkok.
You think of all the five-star hotels we've stayed in our time and all the glamorous places.
I thought, well, of course we're going to have fantastic hotels wherever we go.
We stopped outside this place. I thought, oh, my God.
They put on a polished granite floor instead of a wooden one.
We refurnished it and repainted it.
Telephones, it was impossible to telephone from there. If you would send a telex, it would take 3 days.
Guy Hamilton told me years and years and years later that, in fact, the building that we were in had been the local brothel.
I didn't want to mention that.
We sent the ladies on holiday, left half the unit in Bangkok, and the workers came down.
I was a little shocked. I said, oh, my God, how long am I going to be here?
And we were there for 10 days. I can't tell you what it was like.
Everything left a certain amount to be desired.
And we stayed in the Bordello and went off to work every morning in a little boat.
Wasn't considered safe because there were real pirates there.
Which is not one place I've gone back to.
We had to travel an hour and a half by car and truck to a landing stage. And then from there, take longboats.
And all of a sudden, a chopper came in. And I, oh, this is nice, I'll get a ride back. And into it got Guy Hamilton and Derek Cracknell and the cameraman, and they waved goodbye. And I was left, I wanted to kill him.
Well, you forget about the tribulations and the trials of being somewhere that is a difficult place because of what you get on the screen.
Phuket, which today is a huge tourist attraction and largely thanks to Bond.
I think we discovered that what is now known as the James Bond Islands.
There are tourist boats and the whole tourist industry is built up all over the place.
The Miami Beach of Southeast Asia, it's a huge resort.
So you had obviously Christopher Lee, Elaine Shayek, who was involved with continuity, Maud Adams, Peter Lamont, Guy Hamilton, Vice President of Marketing Charles Giroux, Peter Merton, of course, production designer, Roger, Britt Eklund and Michael G. Wilson, all talking about production in Thailand. Another unbelievably iconic one of the opening shots, the third nipple's revealed. It's just unbelievable.
And there's a music cue as well, yeah.
I just love it so much. But underrated that when Bond... Yeah.
Have you worn it yet?
Does anyone else think that Bond's fake nipple looks more realistic than Scaramanga's?
It's in a different place as well, isn't it? Yeah. He's in the wrong place.
Is that what gives him away, the actual position of the third nipple?
A ring of hair around each nipple.
He couldn't have done that with Connery.
No, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah. Connery and Brosnan, they wouldn't have been able to see them.
You're right. Yeah. He'd have to part his hair every time he sort of showed it. Yeah. I am Scaramanga.
It's on my shoulder, where you can see it.
Yeah.
Christopher Lee in his interviews said when he went on the Bond set, he couldn't believe that, you know how in soaps and stuff all the food that they eat is fake, isn't it, or it's cold and it's replacement stuff, but he said the champagne in the scene was real, oysters were real, and he's even drinking a Guinness, apparently that was real, like this dark glass. So yeah, they were just having a laugh, weren't they?
A Guinness. Yeah,
that's what it's like now, isn't it? Yeah. You'd love to go to that island, and well, just to go to the funhouse.
Yeah, that cowboy.
Yeah,
you mentioned it, Chris. That's a little bit. Is it him or? But with a mustache, and I had to look it up.
Yeah,
it's stunt double.
Yeah,
it is his face, isn't it? With a tat.
So original. Yeah.
It's
these
him
things.
Or it's the other.
Yeah,
waxwork.
I think this is where it might be divisive, you know, whether you like the style of how it looks. It could turn some people off, this opening scene, in some ways, just the style of it, possibly. But you can't help but admire the filmmaking going on and just how bold it is in terms of style. You know, you've talked about, we've got so many iconic images within the first few minutes. And I don't think... not just new James Bond films, but new films in general, are as bold as this. Even though they've got the weight of a franchise on the shoulders, the risks they're willing to take and try and move things in different directions is commendable, I think. It's really, really impressive that within this first scene alone, the setting out the stall, that they're pretty unafraid to try new things.
the shot of the gangster when he comes in and he's in like, he's quite dark because the shade's on him, and in the background you see the island and the music. It's just absolutely fantastic. I like this film.
So one thing I've noticed about some of these Roger Moore films is that the villains like the finer things in life, and one of the main things they like is Tabasco sauce on their food. Both
Scaramanga
and Stromberg have Tabasco sauce. Just a nice little tidbit there that they have a bit of character.
Tabasco.
Yeah.
Knick-knack's almost rooting for this chap to beat him, isn't he? Is it now or is it at the end?
Or this be mine?
So is that the end? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Spoiler. If you haven't seen the film before, then I don't think you should be listening to this. Really, I mean, yeah, it's a waste of your time and our time. So Guy Hamilton, obviously, he knows this guy, Mark Lawrence, and he thought it'd be an interesting idea to have like sort of Chicago style gangster in a totally obscure setting, you know, where, and you can see him sweating, can't you, and he's uneasy with the environment and everything. Before we go into the funhouse, this is, you know, Chris Pinewood set, isn't there? There's like a bit of his hideout, a bit of the like a living room almost. There's like moths on the wall, I think there's a painting of Shakespeare I noticed. I mean, again, this is going really in depth, looking at stuff I hadn't seen before, and it's like partly formed around a cave, isn't it? So on some of the wall there's like cave details and stuff. I'm sure one of the reviews will get onto that much later, but they criticised the production, you know, in terms of the sets. But
what would the criticism be?
It's not Ken Allen, is it?
Well, no, Chris, that was your cue.
Right. I love his layout. Like you say, the fact that it's the, you know, obviously referencing other Bond films, the fact that it's like the chipped away at the inside, and he's built this. Strangely, he's got a gym with his. He's got his gymnastic kind of. He's got a horse, hasn't he? A gym horse.
Yeah.
And then a funhouse. Because why? If that's on your list of things, if you own an. Well, he doesn't own the island, doesn't he? He's living rent free because he does them favours. But so he builds this. He can do anything with this island. So he has a gym. Obviously, he has Gordon Bleu, you know, chef. With Knick-Knack, you know, and then decides to build a fun house with sharpshooter themed, with, you know, the 30s gangsters and cowboys. What more do you want from, you know, you're in Thailand. What do you, you know, what else?
It's pre-Neverland as well, isn't it? Because that's the only comparison I could think of. You know, like, Michael Jackson got all this money, what do you want to do with your estate? Well, I'll build a, you know, circus, or I'll have some animals, and yeah. I'll have cinema, and I'll have roller coasters. Like this guy, I don't know whether it's meant to be. It's just there as one of the rooms, and he converts it for when these people come, and they change it all the time. I'm just rating my mind racing. But I do quite like it. It is like a ghost train, isn't it?
It's
like
It makes no sense, but it's there for the reason, which is that whenever people come, they set up these sort of traps to throw them, you know, that it is confusing for them.
But one thing you can get from it as well is that he's a villain who's a trained, you know, assassin, he's a marksman, he's brutal, and he's amassed wealth through it, and it's a one-man operation, and that's how he doesn't spend, you know, his training place isn't, you know, a dull, dreary place where there are bodies and dummies and corpses and targets and things like that. This guy, he's good at his job and he has fun with it, and he spends his money creating this lair that is just like nothing you've ever seen before.
It does make sense. He was born in a circus.
It's true.
Remember, his father was a ringmaster, so it has like a circus vibe. So maybe that's where it comes from. But going back to before we mentioned about like Knick-Knack, what I really like about that is their relationship. I think it's a great, it's just, you know, that there's like, you know, there is a respect, even though he's like, I'm hiring people for you to be, you know, to one because I want to own everything that you own. And two, this is just really to keep you on your toes. This is a training exercise for Scaramanga. So, but I love the little that even, you know, even though obviously physically they're very different. You know, there's a lovely dynamic between the two characters that watching again that I really like. There's a sort of a fun mutual respect between the two of them.
We'll go into Nick Knack in a fairly soon, but just in terms of the fun house, apparently, well, yeah, we know it was these are at Pinewood, obviously, no spoilers there. But the production designer, as it's Peter Merton, he was obviously slightly coming at it from a different angle, but it was Guy Hamilton's idea of almost, he said, involving Bond in Disneyland. I don't really know what he meant by that, but we've seen the results of it. The funhouse was designed to be a place where Scaramanga could get the upper hand by distracting the adversary with obstacles. Merton described it as a melting pot of ideas, which, as I've just sort of alluded to, it was both a funhouse and a horror house. I mean, there are some skeletons, aren't there, that literally come out of the closet.
But that bit, there's the shot, isn't there, with you hear the laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the head's being projected on the wall and it's turning round.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be shitting myself.
I know, yeah.
Even as an assassin, like, what on earth have I walked into?
Yeah, a bit like...
It's crazy.
A bit like at Peace Glory, isn't it?
I was thinking, I've just realised, I was thinking of Peace Glory. Yeah. Disneyland, that's an interesting... I probably prefer the Neverland reference, though, Tom, to be honest.
I'm surprised people didn't... he's winning the court battle. Right, anyway. So while we've said there was a wax figure of Roger Moore, and then we've also said, the stunt double was the cowboy. There's another chap who played the Al Capone figure. And so, you know, when the music comes in, again, this is snobbery, the word didactic, do you think... that music is being played in the funhouse for the people to hear that? Or do you just think it's on the soundtrack?
I think in my head growing up, I've always thought that it was playing, but I don't think so. I think it's not play. I don't, you know, I think it's purely the soundtrack, but it reflects that. But I mean, I might be wrong.
I think that I think the characters, the guy is bewildered. He seems to interact with the music. There are musical cues to each thing that he does that I think it's perfectly plausible that that's music within the funhouse.
So Nick Knack's like...
You're talking about like the... Do you mean like the clang?
Yeah.
It's like... It's like Nick Knack is being Alan Partridge. It's like Nick Knack's bath. He's doing all these little things to toy with him.
Yeah,
he dims the lights and everything. He does the lighting as well.
And director's commentary.
Yeah.
Mm. But that's interesting, that commentary, because that's a really interesting way that you learn that Nick Knack isn't on Scaramanga's side necessarily, because he's helping. Yeah.
Plausible, though. It's plausible. I really like the way that's how Scaramanga keeps himself on his toes. Works for me.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, like Kato in the Pink Panther movies.
Any moment, someone could be potentially killing him.
Must be a bit of a dangerous place to be. Krah, you know, Krah's just bringing the...
Krah, yeah.
Krah's just hanging about in that big control room and Maud Adams is floating about and they're thinking, God, is someone going to shoot me at any minute?
Is Krah the technical guy who...
Uncredited.
...lusts after a good night?
With the absolute... porno muscle.
That's the one.
He features very highly, very prominently in the Henchman episode, if you haven't heard that. It's one of the greatest Henchmen of the series. I think it is, it's in this scene that Scaramanga tries to go for the guns in the case.
You'll have to look elsewhere, monsieur.
So he doesn't get to. Like you say, Nick Knack's challenging him at the same time, because he's arranged, I assume Nick Knack's arranged all the funhouse and the layout of it. For them both, because he's not meant to have the upper hand at all. He's got one bullet and he's trying to make it as difficult as it can. Because killing is easy. Yeah, because you've got that like sort of the image of Scaramanga's face, which both this guy and Bond think is him and shoot at. So waste bullets on that, and then the laugh, which is brilliant. The horror house again. The step, the false step. He loves it, doesn't he? He loves that. class. Yeah, the saloon and hey Al.
I can't,
what does he say?
Don't hold it against
wherever
me.
Wherever you are, don't hold it against me.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, the music, Matt, I think you mentioned it, how it goes between different variations on the theme song and cutting into the Bond theme, especially in the return to Scaramanga's Funhouse.
Yeah.
It's just brilliantly done.
It's absolutely brilliant, yeah. You know, yeah, I've mentioned previously my love when the theme tune, the theme song, the melody of it is, or part of the melody of it is used within the film in different ways. And I think this film does it really well in terms of using it as an action theme and also like quite a romantic theme, I think, as well, with some of the scenes with Goodnight and Andrea Anders. The, you know,
yeah. Same
and
night.
I love that, and I long for more of that and the film composer's involvement in the theme song, rather than leaving it all to the heavyweights that they hire now.
It sort of really takes leave when I think Nick Knack says that he needs to look for his golden gun, and then in the crow mouth you see it, and then it builds up like, and then there's like the mirrors. Use of the mirrors is incredible, and then absolutely incredible.
Of course, the mirrors were copied. Well, not copied. Sorry, were included in Die Another Day. In the, you know, the secret lab or whatever it is, where
the faceless
totally
place in the Cuba.
Pardon?
Is it the Cuba? The place in Cuba? The faceless
place? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's
all good. Yeah. And the Skyfall main titles. There's a pool of mirrors there, isn't there?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about this because there's an obvious martial arts influence in The Man with the Golden Gun. Is it possible that the mirrors is maybe a reference to Enter the Dragon?
Oh.
Is that possible?
Yeah, it could be actually, yeah.
Complete shot in the dark.
When was that? That would be prior.
Could have been 73, yeah. Yeah, interesting that.
Enter the Dragon was prior to Man with the Golden Gun.
Yeah.
John's researched that because he's going to use it as an exhibit.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. And in the film. So I think, Chris, you mentioned it, the whole pressing the button, the stairs, how they go into that slide. It's pretty well directed as well, you have to say. And then again, it's just like a little roly-poly, isn't it? And... And another shot in the head, proper blood. It's awful for PG.
Yeah, but the way his body takes the bullet in the flashing lights is so effectively done.
And then you've had that, and you're like, wow. And then Bond's there, and it's like, flippy, you know, what is going on? Just incredible, isn't it? I love how you can, in one of the shots, you see Bond slightly shaped, you know, more sort of slightly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Al Pacino, Al Capone. Yeah.
Same person.
Yeah, he blinks.
Yeah. I love how they keep these in. Of course, Robert De Niro played Al Capone.
He did. Yeah.
So were people kind of did people think that Al Capone would turn up in the final sequence as well?
If you're enjoying the Really 007 podcast, why not follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter? Effective immediately. We're not a country club, 007.
In terms of Hervé Villechaize, French guy, and he was actually an artist originally, and then he moved to LA in search of fame and fortune, and this was his big break. At the time when he got this role, he was living in his car in LA, and his job was a rat catcher's assistant. As if that would happen now in Hollywood. There's absolutely no chance, is there? Everyone who's cast has had, you know, hundreds of jobs or you know, they're sort of gradually led in or they're famous already. But I know it's slightly different because he's cast for his looks as well, isn't he? But the guy's fascinating, basically. There is this... well, it's not a documentary. It was an HBO... film My Dinner with Hervé, which is about the Times journalist Sacha Gervaisi, his meeting with him, and it's like in the weeks before he died. Slightly disappointing again, but yeah, Jamie Dornan plays the journalist, and the most famous dwarf, Peter Dinklage, was babyishly chosen to play the French Villechaize. It's alright, but if anyone's seen that,
did he get Fantasy Island off the back of this?
That was after this, yeah. Yeah, he played Tattoo. Look at that name. I actually saw the remake, the film, last night. But it's the Blumhouse horror thing. But it. The premise.
Of what film, sorry?
The premise is outstanding. It's a bit like Lost. Like, people are sent to this island who pay to go to the island for whatever experience they want. And it's like fantasy reality, and they're each intertwining, and you're trying to work out who's which, and it's such a good premise. But it was just done too jokily, and it ran out of puff, and it was, yeah, very disappointing by the end of it. But worth it for if you've got an hour and a half to spare. But anyway, but no, the Fantasy Island TV series wasn't a horror at all, was it? I think it was just a bit of fun, wasn't it? As far as I'm aware, it was occasionally on in the afternoons, I think. When I was a wee lad, on repeat, I think.
I have vague memories of it. I believe that it starred the guy from Wrath of Khan. I forget his name. He was also in Naked Gun.
Ricardo Montalban. Yeah,
that's the one. Yeah, and was there not a control room in that as well, which Hervey was in?
Yeah,
was a control room, and a plane used to come to the island. So eerily,
the plane. The famous quote from it. Yeah.
Quite a lot of parallels with the Man with the Golden Gun.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
He insists on a control room. I
imagine it's dated terribly. You never see it again.
Was there a little peephole as well for him to be looking?
But through? Still, can create a seat that was the right size for him, or he had to stand on it.
Yeah.
Bonjour, Monsieur Bond. I am Nick Nat.
I call him Merve Vichyssoise. He was the sweetest little guy.
Herve Villechaize was a great character. He was great, I wouldn't say womanizer, but he had a great deal of charm.
We used to have a lot of laughs because we'd say things in French to each other.
He used to do quite a lot of drawing when we were out on the location. As a matter of fact, he used to gift me with drawings.
He would leave a flower on my typewriter and type a little note, sort of little love letter.
He would slip them underneath my door into my hotel room in the morning sometime.
So I would type him a little love letter and put it somewhere where he would find it.
Everybody liked him enormously.
He loved Thailand because there he could be out all night having fun and partying.
Hervé had a voracious appetite for the ladies.
He really looked quite frightful for the first few hours and was asleep a good deal of the day, I think as a result of his efforts the night before.
He used to focus his attention on me from time to time. I would just give it back to him, and it was just a game we had going.
Roger Moore, Clifton James, Elaine Schreyeck of Continuity, Christopher Lee and Maud Adams all talking about the unusual habits of Hervé Villechaize. Six minutes. Check. So very, very odd guy. He was eventually fired from Fantasy Island because he wanted as much money as Ricardo Montalban. I don't know why he shouldn't be giving it, but anyway. But also, the main reason he was just propositioning women on the set, sending them love letters on this film. And I think Stephen has a little anecdote for us.
I found a video of Roger Moore talking about this. And I tried to find it again today, I couldn't, but luckily I wrote down the exact quote. So it turns out that Herb was a bit of a pest on set and was harassing all the women and was going out late every night and turning up hungover. So when I rewatched The Man with the Golden Gun last week, I have to admit I spent loads of time looking at him thinking, are you got bloodshot eyes there? Were you out last night? I'm not sure. So Roger Moore was actually laughing when he told this story. He said, apparently Villechaize was constantly pestering Maud Adams. One day, he took her by the hand and said, "Tonight I'm going to make love to you." To which Maud Adams replied, "If you do and I find out about it, you're going to be in big trouble."
Hashtag me too.
So you would never, that story just wouldn't come out now, or if it did, Herve would be in a lot of trouble. But the interview that I saw was clearly an old one, because Roger was telling it and he was laughing. The sort of tone of the interview was, "Haha, this is a funny story, look at this little sex pest." Whereas now, he'd be cancelled, he'd be gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Change days.
because of his size, the people didn't maybe take his threats seriously, maybe, didn't they? Or I don't know. Obviously, quite successful in some of them, apparently. Some of them weren't.
Why do people have to fight? Why don't they learn to do what's right?
You have quite long hair as well.
Why don't they know what children know? We know that love is the only way to have a peaceful
world.
True
love.
All that matter after all. We're happy every time we make a friend. And we're happy dreaming dreams that never end. We greet morning with a song, and most of all, we get along. Why let your life go by so fast? Take time to love and make it last. We may not know the things.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.